And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and in the studio tonight is David Rovics helping me out, and he'll be playing a little more music later on, and then we're going to have a special one-hour David Rovics Earth First Radio Hour. So stand by for that. We're going to read some more news here, and this time we're going to be into animal and plant and habitat news, and David's indicating he wants his beer opened. Thanks to the internet and the Audubon Society of Florida's Center for Birds of Prey and the Orlando Sentinel, people from all over the country, actually all over the world, can witness the growth and development of two baby bald eagles right in the nest. The downy eaglets will grow up in a 75-foot-high tree in central Florida, out in the middle of the Everglades. The exact location is not being revealed in order to protect the birds, but they do have a video camera mounted in a tree above the nest a safe distance away from the eagles, and folks around the world are able to witness this miracle of nature, according to Reese Collins, director of the Audubon Society of Florida's Center for Birds of Prey, a recovery center for injured birds. The website of the Orlando Sentinel has hosted the village of the proud eagle parents since they began nesting a year ago, and if you're interested in that webpage, it is www.orlandosentinel.com/projects/eagle. Once again, that webpage, www.orlandosentinel.com/projects/eagle. And photographer Red Huber of the Sentinel made the initial discovery. Until the hatchlings leave the nest in about 3 months, the video camera will continue to record their development. The nestling survival is not guaranteed. Only 3 out of every 10 eaglets survive their first year. Although under constant parental supervision, there is risk that one or both of the eaglets will not survive. One eaglet might be killed by the larger one, or a parent sensing a genetic defect could off the poor one. Storms and predators also make the eaglet's future uncertain. And in other bird news, a petition by the Center for Biological Diversity to have the yellow-billed cuckoo listed as endangered has finally been ruled on. Executive Director Kieran Suckling says that after 12 years of battling the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service through petitions and lawsuits, the group has gotten through the first hoop of the listing process. A full listing will affect every riparian area west of the Rocky Mountains, Suckling says. Threats to the yellow-billed cuckoo were first brought to the attention of the Fish and Wildlife Service in 1988 by the Western Field Ornithologists, Animal Protection Institute, Defenders of Wildlife, Sacramento River Preservation Trust, Friends of the River, Planning Conservation League, God Davis, and a whole bunch of other folks. The petition was denied. In February 1988, the Tucson-based Center for Biological Diversity filed the petition to list the bird as endangered in all states west of the Rocky Mountains. The petition was co-signed by 12 other bird protection and environmental conservation groups across the United States. You want to try another one, David?
Kex checker, mallow. Kex checker, mallow. Not extinct, just endangered. Sacramento, California, February 17, 2000. Kex checker, mallow, a California native plant once thought to be extinct but rediscovered in 1992, will be protected as an endangered species. The USFWS announced Wednesday.
That's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Oh, thank you. For more than 50 years, biologists believed Kex checker mallow was extinct because it had disappeared from its historic locations near the White River in Tulare County, and Piedra in Fresno County. In 1992, however, consultants conducting a site survey for a subdivision discovered a population of 60 plants in Tulare County. Another population of 216 plants was found in Fresno County in 1998. Together, these two populations occupy a total of about 3 acres on both private and federal lands. However, okay, here comes the bad part, right? Urban development and agricultural land conversion are the primary threats facing Kex checker mallow, said Michael Spear, the service's California Nevada operations manager. And we're not going to do anything about it. Oh, no. Random natural events like disease, drought, fire, or flood also could drive the species into extinction because of its small numbers. The mallow is one of 10 California plants federal judge Charles Beyer ordered the agency to protect after a lawsuit by the Center for Biological Diversity, yay, and the California Native Plant Society. On February 9th, the agency listed the Neyland Prairie Pennycress as endangered. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has until March 15th to make final listing decisions for the Santa Cruz tar plant, Baker's larkspur, yellow larkspur, La Graciosa thistle, Lampac yerba santa, gaviota tar plant, and two species of purple amole. These are all Spanish plants, I noticed.
They were named early on in California's history.
You would think that, like, this used to be part of Mexico or something.
To be again, I suppose. And also in California, the riparian brush rabbit and riparian wood rat are being listed as endangered under the Endangered Species Act, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The two species once inhabited forests along major streams flowing into the floor of the northern San Joaquin Valley. But loss of habitat has reduced the populations of both species. Biologists are able to confirm just one population of each animal in Caswell Memorial State Park along the border of the San Joaquin and Stanislaus counties, but say there may be other small populations in brush outside of the park. The animals face extinction because about 90% of riparian forests along Central Valley rivers have been lost to urban, commercial, and agricultural development, said Michael Speer, manager of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service California Nevada Operations Office. Before development, the floodplain was livestock pasture with brush and trees for cover and escape. Conversion from pasture to cultivated fields eliminated hedgerows that provided travel corridors for the rabbit and the rat. During major storms such as those during the winter of 1997 and 1998, Caswell Memorial State Park was flooded for prolonged periods, so the rabbits and wood rats had nowhere to forage or seek shelter. Survivors were forced to higher ground on cleared levees or fields that lacked cover from predators. The riparian brush rabbit is a medium-sized cottontail, about a foot long and weighing less than 2 pounds, and makes its home in dense riparian forests and seldom moves more than a few feet from cover. It does not cross large open areas, which keeps it from dispersing beyond the dense forests. The riparian wood rat lives in neat stick nest houses or lodges positioned over or against logs on the ground and eats leaves, fruits, and flowers. The Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission has ordered cuts in horseshoe crab fishing along the entire Atlantic coast from Maine to Florida. The decision cuts the harvest by 25% based on average annual harvest from 1995 to 1997. In addition to the reductions, they voted to recommend a closure of all federal waters in a 30-mile radius from the mouth of the Delaware Bay. Now, that's what I call progress. The Delaware Bay is the second largest shorebird migration staging area in the world, and horseshoe crab eggs provide nutrients needed for migrating birds to stop over in the bay. Although reduction is a step in the right direction, environmentalists were hoping for more significant restrictions. Conservation groups and representatives from New Jersey, Maryland, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service were pressing for a 50% reduction to allow the species to recover from increased fishing and to protect the migratory birds and sea turtles that rely on horseshoe crabs for food. And defenders of wildlife and several other conservation organizations have filed a 60-day notice of intent to sue the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the Federal Highway Administration for failure to protect the endangered Florida panther. The groups charge that these federal agencies have allowed negligent permitting and planning activities to infringe upon essential panther habitat. The National Wildlife Federation, Florida Wildlife Federation, Sierra Club, and Collier Audubon Society are also participating in the legal actions. By failing to take the Florida panther into account, the government's actions are setting a precedent which will allow eradication of the only known panther population in the eastern United States in favor of irresponsible development, said Lori McDonald, a Florida representative for the Defenders of Wildlife. The federal agencies are promoting development on lands deemed essential to the panther instead of on already settled lands, the group said. Sprawling human populations, that's us, and development are translating into huge losses of habitat, they add, and combined with panther isolation and inbreeding have caused the panther population to shrink alarmingly. Unfortunately, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has predicted that the Florida panther will probably become extinct within 2 to 4 decades and that a catastrophic event could accelerate extinction significantly. Our immediate goal is the survival of the Florida panther, said Nancy Payton of the Florida Wildlife Federation. Our long-range goal is the recovery of the Florida panther. To achieve this, we are quickly taking steps to stop the rapid urbanization of Southwest Florida's rural lands. This lawsuit is that first step. And we read that after an extensive biological review, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has said that it has determined that the black-tailed prairie dog warrants listing under the Endangered Species Act, but because other species are awaiting listing have a greater need of protection, the agency is not listing the species at this time. At the moment, many other species are at greater risk and in immediate need of protections of the Act. Therefore, we will place the black-tailed prairie dog on the candidate list of species and review its status annually. This, according to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Regional Director Ralph Morgenweck This is a victory, said the National Wildlife Federation President Mark Van Putten. Not according to Uncle Dennis. But anyway, we'll let Mark have his shallow victory. The decision sends an important signal from the federal government to the prairie dogs. Plight is dire, and that serious changes must be made in the way we manage it. The fact that the listing is precluded gives us time to continue the tangible process toward development of strong state-level conservation plans for the species that was sparked by our original petition. Let's talk about wolves for a couple of minutes here. Although scientific controversy remains on the status of the wolf in the Great Lakes states, the process of removing the gray wolf from the endangered species status in Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin has begun. As part of this process, these states must come up with policies for managing the wolf. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources has introduced a bill to the state Senate that calls for a liberal wolf killing policy, even more liberal than the wolf killing bill that the Minnesota House passed last year. The proposal calls for incentive-inducing killing contracts by certified trappers. Don't be fooled. This practice, previously called directed predator control and now called predator control payments, is a 21st century doublespeak for a bounty. It was a bounty that put the wolf on the endangered species list in the first place. The new DNR bill requires that the commissioner pay a certified gray wolf predator controller $100 for each wolf taken, demand that no wolf bounty ever be reestablished. The House bill already passed includes hunting and trapping, while the DNR bill suggests a five-year wait before opening a hunting season. The legislature is likely to shorten that. Tell them to oppose hunting and trapping of wolves now and in the future. There is no justification for trapping of wolves. What can you do? Well, write to the Honorable Governor Jesse Ventura. That's right, folks. Let's see if we can wrestle this guy's mind around into a wildlife state of thought. His address, 130 State Capitol, 75 Constitution Avenue, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55155. Once again, that's the Honorable Governor Jesse Ventura, 130 State Capitol Building, I guess that is, 75 Constitution Avenue in St. Paul, Minnesota, 55155. And if you want to, if you're a resident of Minnesota or think you're a resident of Minnesota, contact your state senators and representatives. Their number is, you can find contact information at 888-234-1112. That's 888-234-1112. Or visit the webpage www.pioneerplanet.com/precinct. Once again, that webpage www.pioneerplanet.com/precinct. And the Defenders of Wildlife, the Humane Society of the United States, and others have filed suit against the Clinton administration for what they call its refusal to abide by the U.S. law on dolphin conservation. The lawsuit targets the Commerce Department's final rule implementing the 1997 International Dolphin Conservation Program Act and creating the new Dolphin Safe label for tuna, which does not exclude tuna caught by encircling nets. The conservationists assert that the rule ignores the requirements of the law and sets requirements for tuna caught by encircling schools of dolphins swimming over and above tuna. This encirclement method has resulted in the deaths of more than 7 million dolphins in the eastern tropical Pacific Ocean over the past 40 years. The law also mandates strict conditions for lifting the 10-year embargoes on tuna from Mexico, Venezuela, and other countries that have refused to adopt dolphin protection programs comparable to that of the U.S. We will demonstrate that the Clinton administration has blatantly violated the Marine Mammal Protection Act's Dolphin Safe Tuna requirements, according to William Snape III of the Defenders of Wildlife. The root cause of this program failure is trade politics and foreign pressure. And despite strong consumer support for dolphin protection and strong scientific evidence, the Clinton administration officials unilaterally decided to open American markets to dolphin-deadly tuna, said Patricia Forkin, Humane Society of the United States executive vice president and leader of the decades-long fight to protect marine mammals. Not only have government officials violated the public trust in the name of free trade, they have violated the law, and we hope that the court will agree. And the case was filed in the United States Court of International Trade. And a novel conservation agreement has been obtained with a private ranching company in Hawaii, which will give the state bird and endangered goose a new lease on life. Under the plan, the Hawaiian goose, or nene, will be introduced into the wild on private ranch land on the island of Molokai, where the bird has not occurred in centuries. The nene almost vanished by 1957 when it was named the state bird. A captive breeding program has released more than 2,000 captive-bred nene, creating small populations on Hawaii, Maui, and Kauai. The agreement between the Hawaiian Department of Land and Natural Resources and the Pu'uohuku Ranch Company will give the geese a foothold on Molokai as well. The project is the latest in a series of endangered species safe harbor agreements built on a model developed 5 years ago by Environmental Defense, a private conservation organization. Private landowners have sometimes been reluctant to allow endangered species to be released on their land because of fear that the presence of such species will result in land use restrictions, said Michael Bean of Environmental Defense. Safe harbor agreements like the one that will be used to benefit the nene get around those fears by assuring landowners that their cooperation and conservation results will not result in new land use restrictions. Nenes are known to forage on cattle pastures. Ranching operations are expected to be compatible with the bird's needs, and the ranch will also assist in controlling non-native predatory animals around the release sites. And moving into news from around the environmental world, on February 11th, the California Department of Forestry approved an amendment to Pacific Lumber's Hole in the Headwaters Timber Harvest Plan. That's THP 97-520. THP 520 is surrounded on all sides by the Headwaters Preserve, which was transferred to public ownership almost exactly a year ago. CDF actions came in spite of explicit direction from the California Board of Forestry to require a legally mandated public comment period and thorough agency review prior to approving any amendments to the plan. Instead, CDF took just 2 days to review the complex 24-page amendment, and the company is now cleared to log on the plan using massive helicopters, which will disturb wildlife and hikers alike. I'm surprised and shocked that CDF would defy the Board of Forestry like this, said Sierra Club's Kathy Bailey. I guess it comes to the Pacific Lumber Company. The normal rules just don't apply. Well, Kathy, get with it. I mean, really. Where have you been? Last July, in response to downstream landowner concerns about flooding in the Elk River, the board unanimously voted that CDF should regard any changes to the Hole in the Headwaters THP as major amendments. Under state logging rules, amendments of this type require a public and agency review and a comment period. Instead, in a move rumored to be at the direction of the governor's office, Gray Davis's silent hand, CDF accepted the amendment as a minor deviation that does not trigger a comment period. EPIC and Sierra Club have asked the board to exercise its independent authority to enforce the forest practice rules and require a public and agency comment period prior to any action on the amendment. The Board of Forestry sets logging policy in California, not Pacific Lumber's friends in the governor's office, fumed EPIC director Paul Mason. The board shouldn't just roll over and let CDF get away with this. Well, I agree, Kent. Can't do more. Anyway, listen for more news about that later on. Uncle Dennis understands that there will be actions on the Hole in the Headwaters coming up. So stay tuned. If you've got some spare time, get your butt up to the north coast of California and help defend the Hole in the Headwaters. I believe logging could start on April 15th. And in other news from California, President Clinton has asked for a review that could lead to permanent protection for more than 400,000 acres of California's giant sequoia trees. Clinton directed Agriculture Secretary Daniel Glickman to consult with members of Congress, California officials, and others to see if it is appropriate to designate the sequoias as a national monument. About 33 groves of giant sequoia trees are in the Sequoia National Forest, bordering the Sequoia National Park and Kings Canyon National Park, and this is just east of Fresno. The groves are already on federal land but are still subject to periodic limited logging. And unfortunately, that's been a black eye for the National Forest Service for a long time. Besides these groves, Clinton is considering whether to add protections to two groves in Sierra National Forest and one grove in Tahoe National Forest. Clinton has already asked for federal money to purchase another grove of giant sequoias on private land adjacent to Sequoia National Forest. In a letter to Glickman, Clinton said he is considering using the Antiquities Act of 1906 to redesignate the groves. The president has used the Antiquities Act several times, most recently last month, to give government protection to land adjacent to the Grand Canyon. I want to ensure that these majestic cathedral groves, which John Muir called nature's masterpiece, are protected for future generations to study and enjoy, Clinton wrote the agricultural secretary. Clinton has said he wants a recommendation from Glickman within 60 days. It is possible Clinton could create a Sequoia National Monument within days of receiving Glickman's recommendation. And the conservation group Save the Redwoods League has purchased 127 acres to expand Humboldt Redwood State Park near Redcrest, California. The property on the park's Avenue of the Giants contains scattered old-growth trees of spectacular size and age. It was owned by the Daly family of Eureka, owners of the Daly Brothers department store. Charles Daly, a counselor of the Save the Redwoods Leagues from 1940 until his death, was engaged in Humboldt County conservation efforts. Through a settlement with Daly's family members who inherited the property, the lands will be brought into the state park system as part of Daly's legacy. And moving north into Oregon, Governor John Kitzhaber of Oregon issued a stunning call to save threatened salmon by breaching four hydroelectric dams on the lower Snake River in eastern Washington. And I take my hat off to the governor of Oregon. This is a bold move. Appearing before a group of Oregon fisheries scientists, Kitzhaber argued that the Northwest is dooming Columbia Basin salmon to extinction unless it acts decisively and soon. He said maintaining river-dependent economies and environmental health is possible in a salmon recovery effort involving dam removal. I believe that one way to do this and to equitably spread the economic burden is to build a recovery strategy that includes breaching the four lower Snake dams, he said. His statement is the first among Northwest governors and those in high public office. It follows years of speculation and more recently intense and divisive debate on the subject. Those whose jobs are connected to the dammed river, among them agricultural irrigators, bargers, and inland port workers, have become fiercely opposed to the dam breaching. Moving to Montana, the U.S. District Court ruled that enforcement of a previously unenforced ban on snowmobiles in Montana does not constitute a new plan subject to new public access. In its 1986 forest plan, the Lolo National Forest instituted a ban on snowmobile use on 400,000 acres of backcountry forest lands. The ban remained unenforced, however, until December 1998, when the Lolo's forest supervisor issued a letter prohibiting motorized access to the area. The Montana Snowmobile Association then sued to overturn the ban, claiming the supervisor was implementing a new rule without public involvement. The court dismissed the challenge, ruling that if snowmobilers wanted to challenge the ban, they needed to do so when the forest plan was adopted 13 years ago. The decision also means that no amount of illegal motorized use can undo a lawful decision to close an area to ORVs, said Jack Tucholsky of the Montana Wilderness Association, which intervened in the case. If you'd like more information, you can call Jack. His number, 406-443-7350. Once again, that's 406-443-7350. All right. I got to look for some short ones here because we're running a little short on time. And of course, all the short ones I've read already. Oh, here we go. More Montana news. The Electric Peak Blackfoot Meadows roadless area north of Butte and southwest of Helena should not be targeted for new roads and logging, three conservation groups charge. In a lawsuit filed in federal court in Missoula, the groups claim the Deer Lodge National Forest proposals to road and log the wildlands violate federal rules that suspended such road building in roadless areas. The federal regulations are very clear, said Sarah Johnson of the Native Ecosystems Council, based in Three Forks, Montana. Mike Dombeck, chief of the U.S. Forest Service, has ordered a temporary halt to road building within the Forest Service roadless areas. We're very surprised that District Ranger Grant Godbolt of Whitehall decided to ignore the chief's decision and attempt logging in the Thunderbolt Creek area of the Electric Peak Blackfoot Meadows roadless area. This is pristine country we're talking about, Johnson continued. This is superior habitat for endangered forest carnivores such as the wolverine, fisher, lynx, and for endangered fish such as the West Slope cutthroat trout. The groups contend the Deer Lodge National Forest proposal Thunderbolt timber sale would destroy the wild south access up Thunderbolt Creek to the Electric Peak Blackfoot Meadows roadless area. Boy, that's a big name. By reconstructing several miles of road and constructing 0.4 mile of new road, joined by the NEC are American Wildlands of Bozeman, the Montana Wilderness Association based in Helena. The Deer Lodge Forest Defense Fund, based in Boulder, helped coordinate the lawsuit. Well, we're going to stop right there because we're running out of tape. And we got to figure out a way to get ourselves out of this. Anyway... We'll ask David to get his guitar ready here, but first I've got a few words to tell our listeners. If you want to get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzef@cruzio.com. That's C-R-U-Z-E-F at C-R-U-Z-I-O.com. Or send your letters to Earth First Radio at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California 95061. And be sure to send those announcements at least more than. That means lots, way ahead of time, folks, 3 weeks in advance. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First Movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon 97440. Once again, that's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon 97440. And you can listen to Earth First Radio on your computer on the World Wide Web at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. You'll need a sound card in your computer, but the software you need to play the MP3 files is free on the website. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations, so please ask your local station to broadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Portions of this broadcast were prepared with the help of Eon Blues. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now let's listen to David Rovix. What do you got for us?
Well, let's see here.
About three minutes of music.
Oh, I'll know. I'll do this song, just a couple minutes of it anyway. It's one of those songs you could just do a couple minutes of, I think. Here's a little song that you might get along with, all about a natural seed growing wild by the side of the roadway. It's nature's wonderful weed. Been around so long, it's hard to tell why anyone think it's new. Love it or hate it, however you relate it, I'll leave that up to you. But isn't that righteous? Isn't that good enough? Ain't that the way it ought to be? Isn't that righteous? Isn't that good enough? Righteous is good enough for me. Well, history's locked in a cardboard box and it's hard to take a look, with sidetrack frills and fantasies written all over the book. Everybody tells you what to think and they've got their reasons why. Gotta pick reality up by the scruff of the neck and look it right in the eye. And isn't that righteous? Isn't that good enough? Ain't that the way it ought to be? Isn't that righteous? Isn't that good enough? Righteous is good enough. Well, I don't know why some people get so upset. You say to legalize it, they'd rather build more jails, arrest more people, and spread more crazy lies. It's like talking to a brick wall. You know, they just don't get the facts. I think they ought to try a little that Betsy Ross. It just might help them relax. And isn't that righteous?
That's right.
Isn't that good enough? Ain't that the way it ought to be? Isn't that righteous? Isn't that good enough? Righteous is good enough for me. I'm gonna fade out here.